This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinion expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekiness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Critics say we should be watching these movies.
But we're here to see if they're right.
Join us as we take a cinematic journey through independent and classic film.
So dim the lights.
And get ready for the show.
This is Art House Legends Podcast, where high art and geek culture collide. This podcast is sponsored by Dixie Doug's Diner. Come for the key lime pie, stay for the hospitality. This is the Mood Dude Eric, and along with me are...
This is Kent, and, you know, cornflakes were invented to prevent masturbation. It didn't work.
Kent stole my shit again. This is Chris.
Oh, sorry.
I'm going to say my shit anyway, so fuck you. Like cornflakes, Art House Legends was invented to prevent masturbation. So there you go.
And it doesn't work.
No, it doesn't.
Awkward.
Awkward.
In this episode, we're discussing The Shape of Water, starring Sally Hawkins, Doug Jones, Octavia Spencer, Richard Jenkins, Michael Stuhlbarg, Michael Shannon, and directed by Guillermo del Toro. So, gentlemen, we are coming to this year's Academy Award-winning Best Picture film, and I have to ask, what did you think about this movie winning Best Picture? Not talking about what you think of the movie itself, but the fact that this beat out the other 8 nominees that were nominated for Best Picture this year.
That is an unusual pick for Best Picture, I just gotta say.
Okay.
Considering what the Academy normally goes for?
Well,
unusual.
Let's just put it this way. They had this year we had practically 2 science fiction films that were nominated for Best Picture. We had 2 war films, yeah. 2 family dramas of sorts, and then, of course, we had 3 billboards outside of Ebbing, Missouri. How do I put this? It was definitely not the traditional Oscar pick, but, I mean, Kent, how many of the Best Picture nominees did you see prior to this for this podcast?
I didn't get a chance to see many of them. Really, the only other one I saw was Get Out, which we did for this podcast.
So you didn't see Dunkirk?
No.
Interesting. What about you, Chris? What was your opinion about this movie winning Best Picture?
I guess I was happy. I mean, I wasn't really... Shape of Water was my favorite film of last year, so... I mean...
Spoilers!
Yeah, spoilers. So, I don't know. I mean, I guess it was cool. I think my favorite thing that I saw from the Oscars was when Del Toro, like, checked the envelope to make sure it said Shape of Water on there.
Mm-hmm.
And just like his reaction to it was amazing. He's just so giddy, and he had like this big ass smile. It was awesome.
And I guess we should go ahead and mention that Guillermo del Toro won his first Academy Award, 2 Academy Awards for this movie, right? Because he was producer for The Shape of Water, and he also won Best Director for this film as well. That means that all 3 of the 3 amigos have won Best Director at least once, and in one instance, twice. So, and we talked about Alejandro González Iñárritu winning his for Birdman. So, I guess, what do you think of the transition over to all 3 of the 3 amigos getting their best director awards?
I think it's great. Love all their work, so, you know, more power to them, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it does show, well, it kind of proves that Oscars So White didn't count this year, so...
Uh-huh.
Or anytime they win, yeah.
The thing is, Oscar So White wasn't really the big thing this year for the Academy Awards.
This year, no.
It was more about the whole Me Too movement, but...
Yeah.
That said, though, I guess the next question that I would probably want to ask is, what was your interest in seeing this film when you heard about it prior to you actually watching this film, what was your interest in seeing it from the trailers or from the initial responses?
Fish sex.
So, is that Abe Sapien and is he fucking somebody? That was my
Yes. Well, for your to answer both your questions, sort of yes, because it's the same actor, but not the same character.
Both the same actor, same director.
We
have a severe lack of Ron Perlman for this movie.
Right.
I guess we'll bring it up about whether or not Ron Perlman should have been in this movie at some point. But
you think a cameo or something, right?
Yeah.
My other thought was, is that Michael Shannon? Is he the bad guy? If he's a dick, I am totally in. Like, that's it. Because he plays dicks and bad guys like nobody else, and he's great.
My God. I think I kind of mentioned it a little bit when we talked about him in Groundhog Day. I have such a love boner for Michael Shannon. I've had one for a very long time now, and to get to talk about him, especially in this movie, which he really should have gotten a nomination for Best Supporting Actor, in my opinion. But I'll try to hold that in as long as possible, although it might come out a little bit later on in the podcast how I feel about that. But anyway, so let's go ahead and let's talk about this movie and kind of what... there's quite a bit here in this film. So Guillermo del Toro, he's known for making monster movies. I think practically every one of the films he's ever made has had a monster in it.
Yes.
What is your first Guillermo del Toro film? And which one do you consider to be his best?
Oh,
and
shit.
How about you go ahead and start, Chris?
I'm trying to remember which one I saw first. I was actually just about to go tech, so.
What about you, Kent?
I'm trying to remember if I actually saw Blade 2 or not. I know I've seen Hellboy, which would probably qualify.
You don't know if you've seen Blade 2 with the vampires, with the two mouths that kind of open crisscross?
Okay, I haven't seen that. I guess I haven't seen that one then. Okay.
Wow.
Just the first one. Well, yeah, it's like, did I see it and it was so bad that I blanked it from my brain?
No,
could have been.
It was good. of the Blade
movies,
it's definitely
the best. But I did
see
Hellboy. But I did see Hellboy, so I'll go on record with that.
Because
I haven't seen...
But what do you consider
to
be...
Yeah, I never saw Mimic.
Okay.
But what
do you consider to be his best film? Other ones that you've seen, of course.
Well, obviously, the Academy considers this one because it won the Oscars. So,
do you consider this to be the best, or do you consider another film?
As far let's see. We're talking about strict direction, correct?
Well, Guillermo del Toro is.
Are we talking about directing or writing? Okay, because he has written a lot. So, let's see here. God, Pacific Rim was just so fun, though. Gotta admit, that's tough.
Alright.
Yeah.
So what about you, Chris? Do you have your answer?
Yeah, I don't remember if I saw Mimic first. I think I saw Blade 2 first of his.
Okay.
And I think Pan's Labyrinth is probably his best.
Alright, so I should mention that my first Guillermo del Toro film was actually was one I saw in theaters, and it was Mimic. I actually went out of town specifically to see this movie just because the trailers look so damn creepy. And I'll be honest here, I wasn't very impressed. I love the creature design specifically. That was some awesome creature design. But the movie itself was seriously flawed. But of course, I saw the obviously theatrical cut, and then of course, you see the director's cut, and the director's cut. Is slightly better. I don't know if I'd consider it to be great or not, but I love Charles S. Dutton in the movie, if that gives any points. But That said, though, when it comes to Del Toro's best films, Pan's Labyrinth is definitely a good movie. Great. I think I really want to rewatch it again and kind of reevaluate it, because I felt that the movie was a little forced. And that's something that I'm realizing a lot whenever I rewatch Guillermo del Toro films. A lot of them kind of have a forced narrative. They don't really flow very well. It's like Del Toro doesn't know how to transition from point to point. He feels like he has to put something into, basically just force his characters to go in certain directions. And especially watching The Shape of Water for the second time for this podcast, I started to notice a lot of the not-so-great Guillermo del Toro-isms that are in this movie. But whether or not that changes my overall opinion of the film, I guess we'll get into in just a little bit. But that said, let's go ahead and let's get into the movie itself. So the setting that we have for this movie is, I think he's saying 1963,
I think, is what everything said.
Well, I noticed it was definitely in the age of Camelot. Richard Jenkins brought it up that this was the Kennedy administration. We got a lot of discussion about the space race, which was definitely a Kennedy initiative. So there's definitely that aspect to the setting. They don't outright come out and say what city, do they?
You see signs that do say refer to it as Baltimore.
Okay, because I know that that Richard Jenkins' voiceover mentions that this is a small town, or a town off the coast. So I didn't know if they outright said it was Baltimore or not. That'll definitely.
I believe so. That or I'm totally imagining, but I'm.
It could be said that the Richard Jenkins voiceover is basically kind of trying to set up a fairy tale aspect to the film, right?
Right.
In a way, this is definitely kind of coming off as being in the same bedtime story anthology that Del Toro's work on Kronos, Devil's Backbone, and Pan's Labyrinth is. Where there's kind of something otherworldly, something fairy tale like, right?
Yeah.
But Chris, you've seen the other films in the Del Toro anthology, right? The Devil's Backbone and Kronos.
I have. I own them. I don't visit them as often as I should.
Okay.
So yeah.
Well, that's no problem. But so. I especially also love the fact that when the film is opening, it also has this kind of dreamlike water aspect where everything's kind of floating in the water, that we're seeing kind of the inside of a room that's filled with water. We'll be getting this image again later on in the film, and water seems to play a large part in the film. Obviously, it's the title, so there's also that. But what do you think about this opening, and what do you think it symbolizes to start off the film? Or do you see it as symbolic in any way?
The vengeful god has flooded the cities. I was wondering if that was a literal, or there was supposed to be a figurative going on.
Well, do you think that she literally? I mean, she does flood her flood her bathroom later on, but with this first shot with everything under the water, I seriously doubt that she actually did it. That she actually flooded her apartment. Needless to say, I don't think that apartment would have been able to hold that much water without it just dropping straight into the movie theater underneath. But what do you get from this, Chris?
Not sure. I was trying to piece something together about if it foreshadows anything like that, and it's just not really coming up with anything. I did like how it's a transition. You see the doesn't like her clock kind of drift down, and then all of a sudden there's no water.
Well,
isn't that how it opens?
Well, I got the sense that the film is opening up to a dream sequence that's where we're actually we're coming in on Sally Hawkins's dream, and she's dreaming of water. And especially the second time around, I caught that on, especially when you pick up the little nugget of information that we get from Octavia Spencer's character where she was found near water. So we get the sense that water is very important to her. So, water is an element that that kind of encompasses her life. She works near water. She lives near water. She dreams of water. So could we, I mean, would it be a very long leap that she would kind of find herself, you know, romancing a fish man?
No.
I mean, of all people, I mean, I think we could believe that she would actually form an attachment to a fish man, right?
That is the strangest yearbook category ever.
Most likely to
get with a fish man.
To marry a fish.
Yeah.
Yes. But like, what, the scars on her neck are, they said it was also from childhood, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was she mauled by a raccoon? What the fuck did that?
I don't know if she knows. Because she was found as a baby. It could have been damage when they found her.
Because other than it blatantly being for like the ending and what those,
well, what happened with those are straight lines, so I got the sense that it wasn't that something attacked her, but that someone intentionally cut her that way. And especially when you have what Michael Shannon says to her about how some people treat children, you get the sense that he even believes that this was something that was intentionally done to her. Perhaps to, I mean, considering that she can't speak, perhaps it was from a parent who got tired of her crying and, you know, cut her in a way that it would stop her from being able to talk. But also, you could also get the sense that the way that it's situated would also make it perfect for gills.
Gills,
which, of
course,
again, if you think about the idea of her being found near water, you could make an argument, and I would not, but you could make the argument that she could be actually a merperson, or maybe perhaps the child of a product of a merperson with a human, in that sense. But
kind of like one of the theories about this being
the first way, because,
mermaid.
Because,
so,
I mean, if we go with the knowledge we find out that we get throughout the film, this is a god. And one thing that we know about gods, especially if you take from Roman and Greek mythology, is that gods have a tendency of coming down or coming to the mortal plane and having children.
And
right? And they become
having
gods
relations
of
mortals.
They're going to have fish babies, aren't they? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, kind of a hybrid of sorts. But I find it very interesting here. There's a lot of different motifs that are being used. A lot of symbols and symbolic elements are being thrown in this particular film. Most notably, the color green. Mm-hmm. Green is everywhere in this film, right? In fact, you'd almost say that the film is practically tinged in green. Either it be darker green, you know, characters are constantly picking green things. I even realized, like, even with Richard Jenkins, well, the actual Richard Jenkins in the film, you know, he's doing red Jell-O and he's told to turn it green.
Yeah,
but
because everything's going green.
So what do you think what do you think green is meant to represent? Because it's definitely symbolic, right? This is
It seems kind of passé to say nature, but, you know, the amphibian man is a thing of nature and brought into man's world of not green. So, that's about as deep as I can go with it.
Well, let's look at the different uses of green. I mean, the pie that that Richard Jenkins constantly gets from the diner is key lime, definitely a green tinge. The Cadillac that Michael Shannon's character gets, he doesn't want it at first because he considers it to be green and is told that it's teal, which is basically a bluish green or a greenish blue, right? And if there's another color that is definitely in contrast to the green in this film, it's blue or it's red. And I don't have to mention what the red stands for, right?
I would say blood.
That's right. And on, it has to also be kind of said that that all the characters are being, they're eating something green or they're wearing something green. In fact, Sally Hawkins' character, I don't even notice if you realize this, she's always wearing green in the film. All of her clothes are green. This is something that I found very fascinating. Green is everywhere. You know, when the merman uses his ET powers, he turns blue, right? Or he has blue sparkles. He kind of pulls an Edward Cullen of sorts.
Ooh, no.
Okay, hold on.
Yeah.
When I saw that, I thought of Godzilla. Because as soon as he does the atomic breath, it, like, glows blue down his, whatever those are. I want to say fins, but I don't think they're fins. So I was wondering, but like, I know Del Toro's like a big giant monster fan. I was wondering if that was just like a slight homage to Godzilla, or now I'm thinking it is Twilight, so I don't know.
Okay, so I guess I shouldn't make this kind of clear that when I first saw the film, I caught some of the vibes that we're getting that are comparing this film to Beauty and the Beast. I felt, and I still feel, that this is possibly the best representation of Beauty and the Beast that we're ever going to get. Watching it for this time around, I actually caught two other movies that this movie is definitely playing homage to and using to as kind of a source guide for the movie. And one of them, I honestly can't believe, is actually being used. And I'm wondering, Kent, if you know which movie that is.
Yes, Kent. What is
about an innocent who finds themselves forming a bond with a fish that is being marked for execution, and this innocent has to go and save them by putting them in a form of water that they need to escape from. Do you know what movie I'm talking about?
You know, for a second I was going to say Free Willy.
Yes.
Like, no. Oh, wait. Yeah, really?
What?
You're comparing this to Free Willy.
No.
Well.
Look at it. I mean, okay, so replace the adolescent young man who's learning how to, you know, live with a foster family, and put it with a lonely young woman who forms a, you know, they both form a bond to a fish. They both, you know that this fish is going to be destroyed. They both plan out an elaborate heist, get them out, and then move them to free water, beat for beat. The other movie, though, I have to admit, I actually found myself really surprised I didn't catch this before, which is another story about a mortal and a gendered fish person. But except that the roles were reversed, also an 80s movie of sorts.
Splash?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, I knew about Splash. Yeah. But
yeah.
Free Willy, I would have fucking flipped over my fucking desk if I wasn't against a wall. But...
So you'd be performing a blackfish? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
But seriously though, I mean, you can definitely see the beats that the film is using, in those templates, right?
I was comparing it more to the Good Old Mermaid and Creature from the Black Lagoon, but
yeah, I was thinking those too.
Yeah, well, Creature from the Black Lagoon was the inspiration for how amphibian man, which is what he's officially labeled here, looks like. But it's the opposite. Instead of a monster-stealing girl, it's Gil steals monster, who was already stolen by the government. So is kidnapping stealing? Yeah, kidnapping is stealing. Depending how you define it. And then it is kind of a bit reverse Little Mermaid thing going on, so. Except neither party can speak. So, except she's got more of a voice than he does, because she can sign, but still, that's...
Well, he can too.
Well, yeah, he learns, but originally he can't. Because he just doesn't know the whole, any human languages, so...
The power of hard-boiled eggs and jazz, man.
Yeah. Time. Kent, is there any way that you can get that rubber ball from your dog?
It's keeping her distracted. I think that's probably
I can hear it.
It's stopping her from barking.
There's no way that I'm gonna be able to edit around that. Okay, I guess the problem is that the way I have to do your sound in order to get the background noise out, quiet you out, but it also kind of brings out any background noises into the forefront, so you're literally fighting the background, which is why you hear me, or the reason why you get those.
She might have mean text. Dropped it. She might be dropping it.
Alright, I'll just try my best to get around this. Okay. Nope, and there it goes again. Alright, whatever, we'll just have to deal with it. Alright, hold on. Time in. So, at this particular point, there's definitely a lot of Hollywood influences that are in this film. Yet, this isn't... When it comes to the Academy, who loves to self-congratulate themselves for Hollywood-isms in the movies, do you think that this movie works on that level? Or do you think that the Hollywood-isms are more... kind of classic throwbacks that are basically just meant for genre lovers specifically.
Well, they work for whenever there is a throwback, they kind of do work for Eliza, for the character living above a movie theater, but nothing too that seems too blatant is going on. So, I mean, the song and dance number, yeah, but that seemed in character for her to have that fantasy.
We'll talk about the song and dance number in just a moment. But what about you, Chris?
I mean, I'm leaning towards it being more classic, I guess.
So you think that this is the element that the Academy probably is able to latch onto in order to get this Oscar, get the Best Picture win for this movie?
Solely because of the homage to older movies?
Well, I mean, let's be honest here. They've done it before with the likes of The Artist, and you could almost say La La Land for like 5 seconds.
That's actually what I was thinking of during that, but I wasn't going to say it since that's like three bad words around here. So
not bad words. Just to expect backlash if you say anything good about the movie.
Hey, man, just the other day, my girlfriend's going on and on about how boring it was. La La Land. And I'm like, I know, you made me turn it off, like, not even halfway through the movie. It was so boring! Thank you. Awesome. One of my favorite movies. Ruining it. Thank you.
Hey, it's not my fault that you're wrong.
Well, it's fine. It's fine.
But all the same, though, I did find it interesting. You brought up the movie theater, and the movies that are being shown there are attached to religion. And in fact, if you notice, there is quite a bit of religion being discussed, specifically
there is,
Christian religion. The movies that are being played in the theater are The Story of Ruth and Mardi Gras. Mardi Gras being a celebration just before before the start of Lent, right? In fact, that's Fat Tuesday is pretty much what Mardi Gras is all about, right? So both are actually parts of the Catholic religion specifically. And then, of course, you have Michael Shannon and what he talks about in regards to the story of Samson and Delilah. I love the fact that, you know, that Octavia Spencer says that her character is named for the good book, and then Michael Shannon kind of tells her parts of the story that apparently she'd never heard of before.
This made me think of his nasty fucking fingers, man.
Okay. All right. So I have to admit, the fingers. let's start off with you on this one.
The finger looking good or nauseating?
You know, you'd figure the doctor would have called him in for checkups every few days and gone, nope, those have to come off. It's not taken.
Actually, there's an interesting aspect to the fingers that I didn't really catch until the second time around. So, the character of the character of Michael Shannon is playing. He is this kind of, he's one of those that is strongly of what we consider the 50s mentality, right? He is a man who is about dedicating himself to his job, to his, you know, being the family man who's providing, you know, he likes things to be in very strict, you know, strict black and white type of details. You know, do this, get rewarded, you know, there's no A for effort, you have to provide results, right? You know, even his fascination, you know, he is married, and yet he does have a fascination with the Sally Hawkins' character, with Eliza, and, you know, and he even gets his wife to basically stop talking so that he can kind of fantasize about her, but...
Creepy or kinky, you be the judge.
By shoving his nasty fingers in her face, man. Ugh.
Yeah.
Oh, but here's something interesting. So, even though he doesn't have any kind of racist elements to his character, not in the overt racist, but in the kind of the subliminal kind of racism, in a sense. You know, when he talks to Octavia Spencer about, you know, not being normal for you people. But I find it very interesting that he puts his fingers back on, and he is, and the fingers are getting discolored. And what color do they eventually become?
Black.
And that when he is threatening Octavia Spencer at the end of the film, that's when he decides to tear off the fingers and then throw them in her apartment along with her husband.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Just those are little elements that I find very fascinating about the film, and the way that it does all this. But do you kind of get those little details, or what would you think about the fingers specifically as a representation, or do you think it was just meant to be some kind of really creepy aspect?
Half creepy, half maybe meant to do with his importance in the situation, because by the time those fingers die, his boss has basically said, yeah, it's sort of implied your career is dead.
Well,
the asset is out, you get him back or you're dead.
Well, let's go through what the general tells him. So, I definitely love how, you know, so Michael Shannon's character is pretty intimidating. He's really scary. He's meant to be kind of an enforcer and really, you know, pulling up the heavy aspects, right? But when he's in the room with the general basically causes him to, you know, lose his, you know, he dirties his tidy whities, right? When the general starts threatening him. And then, of course, you have Nick Searcy, who I can't wait to talk about in Geek Sheet. You know, he's the general in this movie, and the way he talks about how there's going to be this black hole where you are and how you'll be unmade and everything around you is going to be unmade. That is, that is some creepy. I mean, no matter what Michael Shannon does, that just the thought of what's going to happen to him, I can understand why Michael Shannon would be very creeped out by that, right?
Yeah.
It was, yeah.
So General's fucking intimidating, man.
Yeah.
I don't have people tell me to unfuck a mess, like, pretty often, so, yeah. That, like, my universe is going to be, like, totally fucking... I'm going to be a shit stain in an alternate universe where I don't exist. That's great. Awesome.
I actually love that the first part of that monologue where he talks about how nobility and dignity, or I forgot, what was it, like respect, you know, to unfuck, you know, to unfuck yourself, that's okay, but anything besides that, it's an export that we send to everywhere else because it means nothing to us. You know, that whole mentality of, you know, I don't care how you feel, I only care about the results. If you can't give me the results, then you're dead, kind of aspect that, you know, that the film is definitely pushing throughout in regards to this character, right?
Yeah.
But anyway, what do you take from all this, Kent?
What, just how scared he is of the general?
What do you think of the general? What's your impression?
He's definitely used to getting whatever he wants at the moment, and his mind is made up. Don't confuse him with anything else.
Well,
because how he treats the scientist is like, oh, tough, this is what I want. Well, I don't care what you think.
He has the 5 stars, that means he gets whatever the fuck he wants.
I was going to say that, yeah.
Yeah.
Be sure you count him with them, too. We're all going to steal your lines today, Chris.
Yeah. Let's not get that fucking started.
Your lines belong to us.
Sorry.
Pretty much, yeah.
All your lines belong to us. No. But yeah, who is the general afraid of? Probably the president, maybe.
Well, it's Kennedy.
Might not even be. Yeah, might not even be, because... He, in the military, he would have outranked Kennedy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe we should just remember that in 1962, we had the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, I don't even know if it would be the president he would be afraid of at this particular point. I think that it is, in fact, the Russians. And I guess let's go ahead and let's talk about the Michael Stuhlbarg character. Every time I say Dr. Hostetler, I think I keep going back to Big Bang Theory a little bit.
Oh.
Yeah, I know. But, I mean, there's really no, you know, there's nothing that's very similar about these two characters. But, again, I should also mention I have a huge amount of fascination, and I absolutely love Michael Stuhlbarg as an actor.
Oh, he's fantastic, yeah.
And considering the fact that he was in not one, but 3 Best Picture nominees this year, yet still got no nominations.
When is he ever going to get, like, a bigger role? Like, he's always, like, down on the list, and he's always just kind of...
He was in A Serious Man with the Coens. And,
yeah, and everybody kind of brushed that under the rug, it seemed like.
He got a Best Actor nomination for that.
Did he?
Yes.
Oh, cool.
That's pretty awesome.
If y'all haven't seen A Serious Man, we got to do that for Art House Legends, because I look for any reason to...
I remember seeing it. I don't remember anything about it, but I remember not being impressed, so I should probably see it again.
Oh, then we definitely have to do it then. Although we did do a Coen Brothers movie already this year, so we're going to have to in a year or two. But, but Serious Man, yes. I absolutely love Serious Man, and I look forward to even if it's not even for this podcast, just to talk about the movie.
Just do it.
And for the record, he was nominated for a Golden Globe for A Serious Man, not an Oscar. So, Academy, what the fuck? Okay, all right, I'm going to go ahead and just do the rant right quick, okay? So,
okay.
Michael Shannon has only been nominated for Revolution Road, which is a good movie, and he was really good in it. But Take Shelter, he didn't get nominated, and that was one of the best performances of that year, hands down. And for Best Supporting Actor for this one, that should have been a lock, all right? Michael Stuhlbarg, great performance here. I don't think we're going to have any disagreement on that, right? Because this is a nuanced performance. He is playing basically two characters inside the same skin, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot going on here, and we're supposed to be worried about this guy, even though he is a Russian spy who is basically, you know, who's kind of found himself caught between both worlds, right? But he was also really good in Call Me By Your Name, even though that movie wasn't really that good.
It really wasn't.
He has one of the best monologues in that movie, yet no nomination.
He was my favorite part of that movie. So anyway, Richard, keep going.
Richard Jenkins.
Oh, man.
Don't get me wrong. I love Richard Jenkins. Richard Jenkins is a great actor. Should have been nominated for The Visitor, if I'm being completely honest. But in this movie, what does this character do that is all that impressive as a character?
Even
in his big moment in the diner, he doesn't really do anything proactive. I don't get it. I mean, his best lines are the ones at the bathtub. And yet, it doesn't really match with what the film is going for. It just feels like, I don't even know why he even says the things he says at the bathtub. It makes no sense other than the fact that he's basically saying something wise for some reason. Right? I mean, does any of his scenes really match what the film is going for? I mean, if someone wants to defend his nomination, please. I'm really curious. I mean, Kent, let's put it this way. If you were to nominate one of the male actors in this movie for a supporting actor, who would you go for? And I'm actually going to even throw Doug Jones in this movie in for a nomination, because despite the fact that he doesn't have anything to say, he does a really good job getting that across. So, Kent, who would you nominate of these actors, of these four actors, for Best Supporting Actor? Kent? Did we lose Kent?
I don't know.
Hold on. My mic was down. I would say, yes, Doug Jones, for his ability to emote in the suit and communicate without words. I mean, you get a lot of that without him doing anything. So I'd agree with nominating Doug Jones.
What about you, Chris?
Do we just get to pick one?
Well, let's just pick one, just because if it were up to me, I'd pick everyone but Richard Jenkins.
I would pick Michael Shannon and kick myself for not picking Stuhlbarg.
I get you.
I would also be tempted to just, you know, nominate David Hewitt because, you know, fanboy. But
he does have a problem with bad language, so apparently he's related to Captain America.
Well, it is. He's of the right time frame too.
Maybe it's his long-lost uncle.
Just remember, if you're watching this movie, technically this movie takes place at the same time frame as two other movies, Hairspray and X-Men: First Class. So just think about that.
Okay. I'm gonna step away from the movie for just a moment because I have a Doug Jones story that I have to talk about. I met Doug Jones. I met him about 2 years ago. He was at Houston Comic-Palooza.
Yeah,
and I'm just going to say this right now. I don't know what I was expecting when I met him. Maybe someone like refined, you know, this serious performer. The dude is just giddy. I mean, he is possibly the happiest person I've ever met in my entire life. The guy feels like he downs a Red Bull every 20 minutes. That's how much energy the guy has. And so here he is. He's bouncing up and down. He's talking about all of these stories, you know, all of his Hollywood stories about the different roles he's taken. Obviously, he talks about Guillermo del Toro, and he's bringing up that he's doing this movie with Guillermo. But the movie that he was most excited to talk about, the one that he thought was going to be the instant classic of the next year, The Bye Bye Man. Not kidding.
Well, okay. Well, maybe he just had fun making it.
Well, I'm glad that he did, because I did not have fun watching it. Nor did anyone else who saw that movie. That movie is bad. Like, to a degree of bad that I cannot even... I don't even think that you could riff it. That's how bad that movie is. Although I think I might try, just for the challenge. But that said, though... kind of going back to my rant, when is the Academy going to start appreciating men in suits and men doing motion capture?
Yeah.
Or, you know, human beings doing suits and motion capture? Because, quite honestly, I mean, this is not the only motion capture performance last year that was completely ignored by the Academy.
Andy Serkis. Oh, sorry. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You took the words right out of my mouth.
Yeah.
I mean...
He's got about 8 of them now, so yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, for crying out loud, there are so many of these performances that are not getting the due respect simply just because there's a prosthetic that is not really there. I mean, at this particular point, we'd have to kind of differentiate between what is something that the actor brings and what the costumer brings or the digital artist brings. But at the same time, though, we also had this argument before when we had movies like Little Big Man or Benjamin Button or any other movie that had an actor heavily in a lot of makeup or prosthetics, right? And we've had actors who have been nominated. Hell, John Hurt, I believe, won an Academy Award for The Elephant Man. And most of his entire body was prosthetic in that movie. And Ken, you can feel free to check for me if you want, because I'm feeling kind of lazy about this. But, you know, if anything, John Hurt got nominated for it. I know that much. And yet, neither Doug Jones or Andy Serkis got nominated last year. And that is bullshit. That's absolutely bullshit. But, Ken, have you seen War of the Planet of the Apes?
Hold on a second. John Hurt was just nominated, did not win for that.
All right, fine.
Yeah. But he was nominated, though.
True.
Yeah, which, that's pretty good. Yeah, why couldn't...
And it's a great performance. I mean...
It really is,
If you haven't seen The Elephant Man, you got to see The Elephant Man. I think it's... you know, that as much as I love John Hurt in other movies... If I were to say which I think is the best performance he ever gave, it would be that movie. But again, I mean, is anyone going to disagree with this or a different perspective on this?
I mean, does the Academy see it as like a crutch that they're using, like the makeup or the motion capture or special effects as like a crutch for their performance or something?
I think so.
Because that's dog shit, so, you know.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Doug Jones is one of the best at this kind of motion, not just motion capture, but, I mean, he does a lot of prosthetic stuff. I mean, hell, he was, you know, he did two of the characters in Pan's Labyrinth, and that was all entirely makeup.
It's funny, since Gary Oldman just won, and he was, what, in a fat suit and shit the whole time?
Yeah.
Well,
covered
as
in makeup
know,
and prosthetics, yeah.
Being very loud and shouting will get you your Oscar.
Shouldn't he have won for Leon, then? He was pretty loud in that.
No, he only had everyone.
Yeah.
Worth it.
Okay.
Worth it for that. Yeah.
I sense we're off track.
There's just so much I want to talk about. It's like...
Mm-hmm. But water, we must shape it. Oh,
Bruce Lee style.
As long as we're shaping it and not bending it.
That's a great animated series. But
mm.
All right, so getting back to this particular film, and considering that this film kind of has two acts of sorts, right? We have the first act where, or I guess you could say it's three acts, but there's two major shifts. One is between Eliza kind of forming the bond with the fish person, and then what happens after she gets him out, right? And this and the escape actually happens about halfway through the film. So there's half of the film where she's she's forming that bond. They bond over food, and they bond over music. There's a lot more. I didn't realize just how much music this movie had.
Oh yeah,
it was just and a lot of it's really good, even though it's all very, very standard type for this particular era. And then, of course, when she gets him out of the facility, I will say I do have a hard time believing that no one decided to search her apartment.
Wouldn't that be the first place they looked, you know?
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, the Michael Shannon character has such disdain for any of the help that there's no way he ever thinks that the help did it. No, this was the Russians.
I think he just thinks, like, it's the most obvious of solutions. It can't be that, you know? It's too...
That's too easy.
Yeah.
It must be. And even David Hewitt's character is like, I figure it has to be a minimum of a 10-man team, well-coordinated, striking fast. It's like, no, it was a half-assed plan by two people, and two other people jumped in to help at the last second.
I don't know. I'm not buying it. I'm sorry. I'm not buying that at all. This is, I'm sorry. This character would be suspicious of everybody. You know, you're telling me, understand, like, the Rosenbergs, you know, if we're kind of taking this as kind of in our world, the Rosenbergs weren't very noted people, and they were stealing, they stole the nuclear, nuclear secrets. I'm sorry, but I don't buy the fact that he would completely ignore and considering the fact that he did in fact interrogate the faculty, and he basically had one of the housekeepers, the one who stole the fish, basically tell him to fuck himself.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I just... That's one step too far. And you get the sense that Guillermo del Toro is having a lot of fun at his villain's expense. He seems to enjoy making his villain come off as foolish. And I think the only reason why we're not... While we're not laughing this whole premise, or kind of laughing the government off as we are, is simply because of Michael Shannon and his performance. I think that he saves his character from being just basically a dumb caricature, right?
I'm just thinking about his stance on washing his hands and taking a piss, because weird.
If any other actor played that scene, would you find it as intimidating? Or would it just be silly? Let's put it this way. If Tom Hanks did this scene the exact same way that Michael Shannon did, would you find that character intimidating?
Is it like a deleted scene from Road to Perdition? Because maybe.
yeah. Depends on what character he's running. Yeah.
No. No, Road to Perdition, even if he played it like that, it wouldn't be intimidating, because that character wasn't meant to be intimidating. And that would be a conversation for a whole different thing. If we come to Road to Perdition, we can have that conversation. Mm. The only person I'd probably say that could pull it off with the same amount of gravitas to a point where it would be kind of scared would probably be Gary Oldman.
Yeah.
And then he would have...
Being very loud.
Well, as we... I think that's the thing about Shannon. Shannon doesn't have to shout to make himself scary. Hell, I mean, go back to the scene at Octavia Spencer's apartment. I just realized that Octavia Spencer, either she's really good at, worthy of her Academy Award win and Academy Award nomination, or Shannon scared the living shit out of her. You could tell that, and you know that Shannon was, he went full on. Like, if it were me in Spencer's part, and even knowing that that's a performance, I probably would have lost my bowels. When he started to twist those fingers, right? Because he just lays it on fucking thick. That would have been his Oscar moment. That should have been his Oscar moment, because he just.
Unless they didn't tell her what they were planning to do in the scene, and it's like, here's the lines. Okay, hey. If you tore off your fake prosthetic fingers, all right, let's do it.
It would have been cruel and unusual if she didn't know what they were going to do, because, I mean, we've seen Michael Shannon. We know what Michael Shannon is capable of. Yeah. You know, he this is his skill. He knows the right way to emphasize the words, especially with his way of talking with his mouth really close together. Just to make the point.
Well, he always looks like he's on the brink of just, like, totally fucking losing it. Even when has his cool, he doesn't blink, like, ever. Mm-hmm. And then, like, he just has, like, this fucking look on his face like he's just about to go crazy whenever goes south. And it's just like, fuck, this guy's scary.
Well, that's why Guillermo del Toro is a better director than Zack Snyder, because... You know, he could have found her. Just saying. I mean, you don't need Shannon to scream. Shannon gets an obligatory freak out moment. It's something that I think it was my girlfriend that brings up the fact that Michael Shannon has one freak out moment per movie, where he will go completely nuts and he'll scream and shout. And
it's glorious every time. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. If it builds up and, like, does it properly. If he does it all the time, it's like, oh, Michael, you need to tone it down a little bit, man.
I mean, again, I have to go to Take Shelter. Take Shelter has the best Michael Shannon freakout moment of all time. It is glorious. It builds it so well. I cannot say enough good stuff about it. But here, though, I think the freakout moment that he has, it's just him. It's him alone. You know, that's his freakout moment. He doesn't do a screaming match at someone else. He does it to himself. And I think that's very fascinating how they do that. And I also love the fact that... another little motif that I realized, and this is specifically to the Michael Shannon character, is that he's constantly having the future shoved in his face. I mean, the words, the future, are shoved in his face. The first time it happens, it's his son at the breakfast table when he's talking about, you know, do you think that in the future everyone's going to have jetpacks? And then he has the future shoved in his face by his boss. Then he has the future shoved in his face by the car salesman.
Yeah.
You know, everyone's shoving them in his face. And the thing is that he's a man that's on the brink of being in the past. I mean, I mentioned that he's a 50s kind of man, but it's the 60s now. You know, his time is going by. He is not going to live to see the future, even if he wasn't torn to shreds by a fish man, right?
I'm just thinking about his speech about his candy. So good.
That's another great moment. But
fuck your cheek. I'm gonna fucking eat this candy and watch you die.
I love the fact that he basically uses the hole in Stuhlbarg's cheek to basically use him like a fish.
Yeah, he fucking hooks his ass and just
drags him.
Yeah. Oh man.
Yeah, a lot more. Fish metaphors, huh?
Yeah.
But all right, so let's talk about the finale. Or again, no, let's talk about fish sex. Let's talk about.
Oh, okay.
This point, what did the fish sex come out of the blue? No pun intended. Or did you see this coming? No pun intended there either.
You kind of see it coming. They kind of plant the seeds for it with how much time she's spending with them, and she gives him the bathtub that she's been masturbating in every day. And,
well, one of the first things we see her do in the movie is masturbate in the tub.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To an egg timer, which she's been feeding to him. I mean, eggs, you know, but, you know.
Yeah. Well, the giving him the bathtub makes sense, because where else are you going to store that much water for him to be in?
Yeah, but I got to say masturbate, so that's why I brought it up. So.
Ah, yes, good
point. Yeah, well, she has two masturbation scenes before...
She does, yeah.
Yeah, well, even before she rescues him. So we know that she... And then I have to... I actually got into an argument with someone who didn't like the movie on Oscar night of all times over the fact that she felt that the masturbation scenes were... that this was not necessary, not needed. And she also thought that she was basically taking advantage of a mentally deficient creature for sex. So she was a sex predator, so to say. And for that, I'm going to say, when it comes to those, and I'll leave y'all the floor to bring up your own opinions about all this, but in regards to the masturbation, I think that we need to establish the fact that she has needs that she's not getting, and we get the sense that either she, I mean, we don't actually see anyone kind of say no to her, but we get the sense that she feels like a freak to others, so she isolates herself, right? Because we don't ever have a scene where she's like trying to get someone's attention and they shut her down because they think she's weird. In fact, everyone that comes across her seems to be very nice to her, with the exception of that one lady at the time clock who seems to be pissed off that Octavia Spencer is saving her spot, right?
Well, it's a no cuts rule. I can see why. But the thing is, everybody is lined up to clock in, like, right before a minute. Nobody clocks in like a minute before just to say I'm clocked in. Blah. So unless it is one of those places that gets upset if, oh, you clocked in early, you shouldn't do that. Like, what?
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the post office was like that. Actually, I think that's any federal job now that I think about it. Oops. But yeah, you'd have lines of people that, but you know, you could clock in that person farther back in line. That whole line could clock in less than a minute.
Yeah.
That's just how it works. As long as you've got your time card. Yeah.
But do you see her taking advantage of this merman for her own sexual desire?
No. I think if the merman wanted to, he could have just gone no and pushed her off.
Yeah.
He's not in a position where he couldn't refuse.
Well, technically, I mean, he couldn't refuse because he is at the point that they're having sex. He has to live in her bathtub because she's got the things that he needs in order to survive. And it's not clear that he knows where the ocean is, or that if he even knows that the ocean is even around him. So basically, if he doesn't stay in that bathtub, he dies. Right? Or, you know, if he doesn't get back to that bathtub on a regular basis, then he dies. So you could say that he is dependent on her.
I think it's still his choice.
But what about you, Chris? Where do you stand on all this?
I kind of felt like she... Like it was like the whole need thing with the masturbation stuff with him. I mean, she says it in the movie. Nobody's ever looked at her the way he looks at her. He doesn't see her for her flaws or anything like that. She sees her for what she is.
Well, and we don't actually see him emote in a kind... We don't exactly know exactly how he shows passion. I mean, he shows that he understands what she's saying and that they're talking, but we don't get the sense that there's a care or a love, so to say, between them. You know, because all that they talk about is egg and friend. You know, that's pretty much where it all comes down to. Music, egg, and friend. That's all that they really talk about. You know, they don't have, like, long soliloquies where they're discussing their emotions. In fact, we don't even know if he has emotions. Right? Other than, you know, oh, there's a cat there. Let's see what its face tastes like.
Okay, you brought up the cat. I'm wondering, like, okay, he has the power to heal wounds and give bald guys their hair back. Why couldn't
so
he bring
say
that?
He shows more care and love for the Richard Jenkins character than he does for Liza, right?
But if he could do that, why couldn't he bring that cat back to life or regurgitate its face back onto its body?
Probably because it was 100% dead.
Well, I think we're in the point of all dead. You know, not near yeah. dead, not mostly dead,
dead.
All dead.
Dead. Yeah.
Mm. I have a feeling we're going to have to eventually get at some point to Princess Bride.
Yeah. Inconceivable we haven't done that. Okay, moving on.
But seriously though, he does more to heal Richard Jenkins, with the exception of at the end, than he does for Eliza, you know. Eliza seems more like obligation, or kind of like, well, you've helped me, you've done things for me, so we're cool. But the times that he's like showing remorse, it's to Richard Jenkins. You know, he bows his head to Richard Jenkins at that particular point after he eats the cat. So do you think that perhaps he actually had more affection for Richard Jenkins than he did for Eliza?
Well, he felt bad once he realized that the cat was not there for him to eat, so he had to apologize to him. He hasn't had anything to apologize to her for.
Well, you know, ruining her bathroom.
That was her decision.
Yeah, she's the one that filled that shit
yeah.
up.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. So yeah. Okay. Let's talk about. Yeah. Okay.
There's no way that room could have held that much water.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so first off, can we all agree that is a pretty awesome scene? I mean, just as a visual.
Oh, yeah.
A visual scene, that was pretty fucking awesome, right? We can all agree to that, right?
Yes.
Sure.
That said, there ain't no way that how it was she did would have literally happened at all.
No.
And I will say that I found it very interesting, because there's the first scene, the first time that we do the kind of, you know, from the bathroom, we pan down to the theater, you know, that opening sequence. There's two dead rats that are between her floor and the ceiling of the theater, right? Part of me was wondering, did those rats get washed out when that water started dripping down from her floor?
Only if there was a gap big enough for them to fit through.
And it only made me wonder, it's like, where did those rats find themselves? And part of me wonders if by some chance those rats made its way into the popcorn machine.
What?
I'm sorry, I had this weird thought. You know, I just wanted to see if the rats would turn up somewhere, these dead rats. Right? Or I guess I should say the skeleton of the dead rats.
Okay.
I'm sorry, it was an interesting detail to put, like, these two dead skeleton rats
yeah,
in between the
yeah.
floors. I mean, that's a the weird floors. Visual element, right?
Well, there's a lot of visual elements here and there that get shoved in, like the movie reels in the connector between the two apartments. There's a joke on a certain thing we saw that's like, every apartment is painted in Del Toro brown. So,
Well, no, it's all green. It's
well,
all
the apartments themselves are not green. The walls,
actually, they are.
They
that's
are.
The,
that's
yeah.
a weird. That's a dark, weird green.
Yeah. Well, it's but, it's this kind of murky, darkish
yeah.
green vibe to it.
Hmm.
But. Yeah, no, it's almost practically entirely in green, just in different shades. But no, the thing is that in regards to I was going somewhere and I completely forgot where I was going to go. But what about you, Chris?
What are you? What was the question?
The visual.
The visual touches in regards to the...
Oh, with the rats and the movie things? Yeah. Oh. I've seen the movie. I can't remember if it's two or three times. I never noticed the movie things, the movie canisters, and I've never noticed the rats. Yeah. So...
Really?
Yeah.
We might have to revisit this at some point. Maybe. But also... I also find it very interesting the type of the movies and the types of TV shows that Eliza and Richard Jenkins watches in the apartment, because you know when she's watching the news stuff, he demands that she changes the channel because he doesn't want to see the civil rights events, and then they go into old movies, whether it be you know an old Shirley Temple film, especially musicals. You know, they do have this little dance vibe that they do together, which makes me wonder, exactly how many musicals have they seen together?
All of them.
A lot. It looks like that's all they do, is watch musicals. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I will say, so when we get to the actual musical, the musical scene in the movie, the first time that I saw it, I laughed my ass off. I mean, just... seeing the merman in tux and tails,
dancing.
You know, dancing along to this to Sally Hawkins singing this old standard. I mean, didn't it kind of feel like a Mel Brooks type thing at this point? Wasn't anyone else expecting the merman to start singing "Putting on the Ritz"?
I wasn't expecting that, but you know, It was just a surreal dream scene, but if you wanted to think they were going to start in a weird super tap dance mode and stare at the camera and he was going to start lip-syncing too.
That would be a lip-sync battle I would get behind.
Oh, yeah.
Merman versus Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Just saying. Fallon, get on that. But... Alright, so we mentioned the sex scenes. Do you firmly believe in the relationship, the love story aspect between these two characters, beyond sex? Do you get the sense that the merman actually has a romantic feeling towards her?
I mean, he seems to care about her, at least. I'm not sure if it portrays, like, intimacy type... emotions from him in the actual movie.
Yeah.
It just seems kind of implied.
Yeah. So, because, you know, as I was watching it for this time, I also kind of found myself... Did y'all ever see an episode of Robot Chicken that was done for E.T. in regards to the E.T. is basically the special needs kid that was maybe left on Earth on purpose because he was annoying everybody? And then... You know, they find that they really couldn't leave him on his own, so they had to come back and pick him up. Part of me was kind of thinking about that while watching this movie, that you know, basically, you know, he has these godlike powers, but you know, basically he's just you know, kind of like a dude bro kind of thing. You know, sorry, I was going somewhere and I completely.
Yeah.
So, all right. So y'all don't get the dude bro vibe from Fishman here?
Not so much.
Yeah.
It's like, oh man, I just like totally smashed on that chick, man.
Who is he saying this to?
Yeah.
He was saying this to Richard Jenkins.
No, it's not going to work. Jenkins isn't going to care. The wrong guy. He's got key lime pie on the brain, man.
Yeah.
No, by this point, he doesn't have key lime pie on the brain. Remember, the whole reason he decided to go along with this cockamamie scheme was because key lime dude showed in the span of like 90 seconds, not only is he not gay, but
he's a racist fuck.
Yeah. You know, I love the fact that, you know, they make this big thing about the fact that he works at Dixie Dugs. He doesn't even have a... He's not even from the South. He's from Ohio, you know, and, you know, kind of comes off as this nice, sweet guy. And then, of course, the moment that he realizes... I don't exactly know what it is that he's expecting from Richard Jenkins, though. That's the thing about this I don't get, because it's painfully clear that there's a flirtatious aspect, and he seems to be going along with it. Yeah. And you could put it up to the fact that he's never been hit on by a guy before, but he allows himself to get very close. I mean, this is like, he doesn't have any borders or any walls open. And so either, I think the best I could say is that he is closeted, but that he is kind of trying to keep this front going, of his sexuality. That's the best that I could come with. And I don't know. We don't get enough, because after this scene, we never see him again.
Yeah.
Right?
If you saw him again, it wouldn't really matter, I don't think. You don't care about him after that scene, really.
Well, I don't know, though, because I feel like there's, you know, that this was kind of done haphazardly. I think it was basically just meant to be there to draw. Because basically, before this, he's not going to go with it because he's wanting to put together kind of a normal life, right? He's trying to get his old job back, which leads me to wonder, how did he lose his job in the first place? They make a mention about him being an alcoholic or a former alcoholic, which you could see as being kind of tied to his closeted lifestyle. So, you know, and the fact that he talks about, you know, if he'd go back and tell himself to fuck more, which...
Take better care of his teeth and fuck more, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so you have...
It's good advice.
That is definitely true. But, of course, you know, that also leads to the idea that he had been closeting himself for a very long time and probably trying to deny his own sexuality. And also, you know, his entire character arc is completely removed by the second half, right? He goes nowhere. He doesn't find love. His... you know, he basically encompasses her mission as his own, and he doesn't go off to Mermaid Land. He's basically stuck. In fact, if you want to think about it, he's probably going to be living the rest of his life in a jail cell, right?
Well, it's not really his story, though. That's the thing. It's Eliza's story, and like her encounter with the Amphibian Man.
But
he's kind of just an afterthought.
He's the narrator, though.
Yeah, that's the most important thing he's got going on, is narrating Eliza's story.
So I guess the question should be, who is he narrating it to? Because
Fish babies. Fish babies.
Us. We are the audience. We are, whoever we are is the audience that he's narrating it to.
But here's the thing, though, because he makes it out as a fairy tale. And, you know, fish babies would definitely make the sense. But... do you kind of get the idea that perhaps he might be spinning a tale of his own to the feds about what's happening, about what happened?
He's got to tell those cops something at the end.
Because, I mean, let's just put it this way. Here, he's basically right in front of a dead federal officer. He was the last known accomplice to a woman who has, at this particular point, probably has been actively accused of stealing vital, you know, national security secrets, right? So he's gonna be implicated in that. Not to mention the damage that has been done to the. To the theater apartments and stuff like that. So he's probably going to get ruined there. In fact, he is going to have his entire life ruined by this fish man and the woman he considered to be his best friend. So why would he have this romantic story between the two?
Because it's a good story. Look, the movie version, 50 years later, wins the Academy Award. No, it is a good, I mean, he's got a good story, and if anybody goes, I don't believe you, he could go, yeah, it's fishy. It's a weird story. It's a far out there story, but.
Here's something else that I'm thinking. Now, we know that Richard Jenkins is an artistic type, right? He does drawings, yes, and stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
What if it was the fact that there's things about the story that may or may not have actually happened, but that he's interpreting it in a way that makes his best friend a hero, and that he's telling the story in her memory. Things that didn't happen, but things that he kind of wants to happen. Then perhaps there wasn't perhaps there was a fishman, but perhaps the fishman killed her, or that she killed herself, or that she died at some point. Go ahead.
I kind of think that is what happened with the ending.
That this isn't his interpretation of, perhaps a fantastical interpretation of her death?
Either she did die, or her and the creature died, and he's just kind of having this fantasy that they lived happily ever after.
Especially as he's rotting away in a jail cell for the rest of his natural life?
Well,
because they're going to need someone to blame for this, and he's the only one that's left.
Blame for what?
Zelda's there too.
They never had anything. What could they possibly have stolen? It does not exist.
Not to the police themselves, but to the laboratory, to the national.
The laboratory is being gutted. It does not exist.
They're still going to want to hold someone accountable for this loss.
You'd have to take them to court. And what are you going to tell? What are you going to tell a judge?
No, you don't. We live in the age where people disappear. They disappeared before then too.
Disappearing him could add more questions, so you just gut the operation.
Who would ask questions? Just he the lives building by is himself. Empty.
But Zelda doesn't.
She has Brewster, and I think we've seen how much of a spine Brewster has.
He'd still be concerned. He would have family that would go, hey, where'd Zelda go? So,
no, they
won't.
No,
if everything just disappeared, they have nothing to stand on.
No, I'm telling you right now, they would find a way to punish them for what happened. But
if you're a member of the federal government into Black Ops, tell us who's right here in this situation.
we know what would happen nowadays. Yeah, they have special places.
Yes.
For
wait
for
a minute. A Shape of Water board. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Now you're getting it.
Yeah.
All right. So, Chris, what do you think of the ending? Do you think that it was literal? Do you think that it was interpretation? Do you think this is in the mind of Richard Jenkins? What's your opinion?
I mean, I was taking it as literal, but as you were talking, I was kind of thinking that Giles is actually just the gay male version of a crazy cat lady and is just talking to his cats via narration.
It's true.
Explain to his cats why Eliza is no longer around?
Yep. Yeah. I own 5 cats. I know how crazy you can get. So,
yeah.
But he would do that to the creature that killed one of their own? That he would make out the cat killer as...
He's got to explain why... Which one died? I don't remember which one died. Was it
Pandora.
Thor?
Pandora.
Pandora.
Yeah.
Gather around. Let me tell you the passing of Pandora.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Again, another tie to mythology and to gods, religion.
Mm-hmm.
But all the same, okay, so at this particular point, were there any other aspects of the film that you want that should be brought up? I know that we're running a little late.
Yeah. Oh, let's see. We got the ending covered. We got...
What about Andre Desplat's score? The Academy Award winning score for this film?
I like it a lot. I have a copy of it. I had it in my car for a little bit. After one or two listens, I never listen to it again. On the other hand,
if I listened to it on its own, I'd probably fall asleep.
On the other hand, Desplat's score for Isle of Dogs, so good. It goes by so quickly. It's 45 minutes. It's amazing.
We'll have to get into that when we get into Isle of Dogs. Oh, did I spoil anything? Oh, sorry. But what about you, Kent? What's your opinion on the score? Do you think that this should have won over something like John Williams or any of the other nominated?
God, I don't remember what the other ones were nominated.
That's a question. I know the instrumental soundtrack was I really liked. The score, though, that's... I have to look again to see who got nominated against, because that's one of those strange things. Let's see, what is this?
Okay.
Yeah.
So the nominees were Johnny Greenwood for Phantom Thread, Carter Burwell for Three Billboards, John Williams for Star Wars, and Hans Zimmer for Dunkirk, which I think you said you didn't see any of those, but the exception of Last Jedi?
Just The Last Jedi.
I'd still pick Shape of Water out of those nominations.
Yeah, okay.
My girlfriend would have definite problems with you because she's all about Johnny Greenwood's score for Phantom Thread. And while I agree, I think that one's an awesome score, it's between that and Hans Zimmer would have been the one that I'd pick, but Dondre Despot did a good job here, I think. But I will say, though, as I was watching the film the second time around, there was a strange amount of accordion, and it kind of reminded me of the scores for Jean-Pierre Genet's work, like with Amelie, or Very Long Engagement. Ken, I think you remember our discussion about Amelie and what we thought about that score. Mm. Or not.
Yeah.
I see how that is. Very well.
Away, peasant.
But did y'all find yourselves feeling like a kind of a French artsy style for this music?
Sometimes.
Kinda, yeah.
Yeah.
But, all right, so at this particular point, is there anything else that...
I think so.
That's what I'm trying to think here, if there's any other aspect here or there. Just David Hewitt's character seeming out of character where everybody else is being badass, and he's like, no, nobody cuss. Come on, let's be nice. Let's not swear. This is my car. What are you doing stealing it? That was all levity in it. So, what about the Russians? The whole Russian plot.
They were there.
They were there.
Well, I think it was just again tying into the whole Cold War aspect. I think that in a way it sets up a reason for the Michael Stuhlbarg character to help. Rescue the merman. On top of that, again, I think it's also setting up the counter. You know, or trying to set up the idea that, yeah, the American government is this big and bad, you know, uncaring, all about, you know, their own interests and not caring. But it's basically also saying that, you know, the opposite is exactly the same. That the communists would have done the exact same thing, that they're as much interested in, you know, making sure that the Americans don't learn more than it is that they learn something, and that they, if it's not going to benefit them, then burn it to the ground, right?
Yeah.
And I guess the question I have in that regard is that they want to kill the merman to keep the Americans from learning, but if you kill the merman, doesn't it mean that they're going to just do is dissect him anyway?
Yeah.
I mean, you'd have to not just kill him, but you'd have to dispose of the body. But then they do ask, you know, what did you do to the corpse after you killed it?
Did an autopsy, yeah.
But I guess they were expecting Michael Stuhlbarg, who is like, 2 feet smaller than the merman, to dispose of the body on his own without any help. So that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Interesting.
Yeah. Well, I think they figured the longer you study him alive, that's more information you get. And the Russians weren't counting on, you know, Michael Shannon's character to go, yeah, let's just kill him and get it over with kind of attitude.
I get you.
Yeah, I mean, same goal, and you have the scientist going, no, don't just kill him. Telling both his masters, don't kill him.
Alright.
Yeah.
So at this point, is there anything else, or do we want to go into Geek Sheet?
I think it's probably Geek Sheet
time. I think it's practically Geek Sheet time. So.
Alright, kids, start us off on the Geek Sheet.
I know you'll
Geek
have
Sheet O'Clock.
Stuff. Yeah, oh yeah, Geek Sheet O'Clock. well, we've got Michael Shannon there for that we need to kneel before Zod.
Being really excited for WrestleMania, yeah.
Yeah, kneel before Zod. Richard Jenkins.
Also, we should mention that later on this, in about next month, we're going to see Michael Shannon again on HBO's version of Fahrenheit 451.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I never watched that trailer.
Yeah. So, Richard Jenkins was in the Let Me In, which of course is the American version of With the Right One In, which we've covered, and Cabin in the Woods and other stuff. Octavia Spencer. Oscar winner.
For The Help?
Actually, wasn't it for Hidden Figures?
Nope.
No, it was Help? Okay.
Yeah, she won for The Help.
Okay. I know she has won an Oscar. Michael Sternberg.
Hold on. I think you're forgetting that she also has a tie-in with the Marvel universe.
She does?
Yes. She was the one who warned Peter Parker about going into the ring with Macho Man Randy Savage, that by signing the waiver that they're not liable for.
She's in the first one?
Yeah.
She was
the one who gave Peter the waiver.
I just had to scroll way, way, way down to find that, because she has been in so much stuff over just the last decade.
Mm-hmm.
So, damn. Let's see. Oh, I lost my place. let's see. I was up to Michael Sternberg.
Stuhlbarg.
Yeah. Saw him in Doctor Strange. You guys have talked about a lot of his other roles that I haven't seen him in or recognized him in.
I could spend an entire podcast IMDb.
Yeah. He was the best part of Men in Black 3, so...
Yeah.
I loved him in Men in Black 3.
He was great in Men in Black 3. The rest, you know...
I liked it. Hey, I'm just saying that on Men in Black 3, there is a lot of MCU ties, let's put it that way. MCU and DCEU. It ties them all together.
Yeah.
Ugh.
All right. Go to Doug Jones.
Doug Jones, Indiana legend. Graduated Ball State. Did you know that? No. Yes.
No.
Been in like everything. So, recently Star Trek Discovery, where he had lines and everything. You could hear him talk. Yes.
Lucky.
Original Hellboy, Panzer Imbrimph, you could almost make a show based on an entire series based on his IMDb.
He was the body of the Silver Surfer.
Yeah.
So
go ahead.
Let's see. Jumping back and forth here. We got David Hewitt, who I've mentioned a few times, as everybody knows from Stargate. Come on. It's McKay. Except he's got a mustache now. Does that make him the evil McKay from the parallel universe? I don't know. Let's see. The Russian head is an actor named Nigel Bennett, who I looked at and recognized immediately because I used to watch a show in the 90s called Forever Night, and he was on that and Lex. So I don't know if you're familiar with those. So, but it's like, is that? Yes, it is! And Pie Boy Morgan Kelly recently was on a show called Killjoys, which has been a popular show that I really need to start watching. Actually, I think it got canceled, but I need to watch it. So,
I can't believe that you completely missed out on Sally Hawkins, the Academy Award two-time Academy Award nominee. Are you going to forget that she was in both of the Paddington movies? She was, in fact, uncredited in Star Wars Episode One.
She's uncredited, so I'm like, does that really count if we can't see her? And I've never seen a Paddington movie.
Me neither, but I knew she was in one of them.
Y'all are wrong for it. Yeah, just go on to Netflix. Okay. Go catch it. It's actually,
I heard the second one's really good.
Actually, both of them are really good. But when it comes to... Because I found her with Happy-Go-Lucky. When I saw her in Happy-Go-Lucky, she was so impressive in that. I've been paying attention to what she's been doing. And she's done everything from Jane Eyre to Great Expectations. She's done Woody Allen. I know that it's not a very, popular thing to say, but she was in Blue Jasmine, where she played Kate Blanchett's sister. She was really good in that as well. I actually would love to see more Sally Hawkins, if possible. Although I will say that she definitely has a face for the indie scene. She's not what you would consider to be the Hollywood glamour.
I was about to use that same phrase. Yeah.
Huh?
I was about ready to use that exact same phrase.
But she is an incredible actress. She's got a wide range, and I think that she makes for a very interesting character, a very interesting character actress, which her IMDb page will show you she is just capable of doing. And yeah, I can't wait to see what she does from here. I guess on my end, I would probably just bring up that when it comes to on the crew side, Sidney Wolinsky, the Academy Award nominated editor, was involved in movies like Howard the Duck. So, you know,
that's a good thing.
Yeah, classic.
Also, like House of Cards and Ray Donovan, Boardwalk Empire, lots of classic television, or, you know, what's essential television of that whole new generation. But, yeah, it's very interesting to go back and check out what Sidney has done in other shows. Obviously... You know, Guillermo del Toro has done practically everything, which we've mentioned, and I have a feeling we're going to have to talk about Pan's Labyrinth at some point. I would say that, most of Guillermo del Toro's crew has worked with him forever. Yeah. So, you know, most of their stuff kind of works with him. But anyway, so at this point, let's go ahead and let's call it right quick. Kent, Chris, do you agree with the critics on The Shape of Water? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail? Or do you give it a maybe? Kent?
I give it a solid pass. Definitely a future classic to look back on. Without reviewing every other film for Best Picture, not sure if it does beat them all out, but it has all the elements and that it should have, that I could see it winning. God, I think I've exhausted everything I was going to say about it. So, pass. Yes.
Chris.
It's a pass for me, too. I mean, I already said it was my favorite movie last year. I didn't like it as much in repeat viewings, but I mean, it's still really good. It's one of the few movies to make me cry, so there's that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I always have a soft spot for Del Toro movies, and this one is like, it's gonna sound weird, but the softest spot, I guess? I don't know. It's a pass, let's just leave it at that.
Okay.
So I should say that this film feels kind of pedestrian for Guillermo del Toro. That said, though, I guess it's not his most pedestrian. I think Pacific Rim is probably his most pedestrian, but this is a film that I can't help but feel is one that is his most accessible, though. It's one that you could pretty much get anyone into Guillermo del Toro by showing them this movie. I'm really glad that Guillermo del Toro won his Oscar for this, as opposed to probably something else. I think it would have probably been better if he had gotten it for Pan's Labyrinth, but I'd say I actually like this more than Pan's Labyrinth, just because it's a little bit more character-friendly. It doesn't have the same amounts of jumps back and forth, and you don't find yourself questioning the narrative as much as you do with some of his other more heavier work. That said, though, there's problems with the narrative. There's problems with the overall, the delivery of what this film is going for. And a lot of it is basically because it does feel like it's trying to be a fairy tale to the detriment of kind of how it's presenting the characters. That said, though, it's a fairy tale that I would come back to. It's one that I find very fascinating and beautiful and gorgeous, and it was my number three film of the year for good reason, and I still really enjoyed the film and can't recommend it enough. So this is definitely a pass, and if you haven't seen it, go check it out. And I'm glad that this is the first monster movie to win Best Picture, and the second science fiction the second science fiction film to win Best Picture. So there you go. But Kent, what do we got coming up next?
Next time on your wonderful podcast channel, we have an old classic about the end of the world, Doctor Strangelove.
Oh. Going back to Kubrick.
Yes, and we're going to bomb things. Going to bomb the world.
Bomb. Oh.
Ew.
But if you agree with our opinions or disagree, feel free to let us know what you think. You can do so on our Facebook page or at the Art House Twitter feed at Art House Legends, or you can send us an email at arthouselegends@gmail.com. We'll get back to you as soon as possible. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me for this episode. This is the Movie Dude Eric.
This is Kent.
And this is Chris.
And...